You're supposed to say the lines.
Oh, is it? I gotta say that?
Yes.
Public service announcement. If you're using opinions or other opinions.
Fuck that bullshit. They are my opinions. And my guests. No one else's. Remember, this show ain't for Chitlin's ears. So listening discretion and viewing discretion is advised. This is a paranormal horror crime show. So the scenes and the sounds can be a little terrifying to those little ears and those little eyeballs. And of course, there's obviously cussing. I mean, it's me. Oh, please don't do anything that these stupid-ass people do in the podcast. This is for entertainment purposes and for you guys to listen with your ears. Consume the knowledge. And now, time for the show. What is up, everybody? It's Sharna with Exploring the Paranormal Perspective and founder of Geeks Paranormal, and I am here with the lovely Liana Renee Heber. She taught me that one. How are you, my friend?
I am so glad to be here. Thank you so much, and happy Memorial Day weekend.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Happy Memorial Day weekend to you. And you have been a busy bee. I mean,
it's been quite a year. So yeah, so I'm excited to talk about it.
Now, we wanted to talk about your lovely book that she sent me, and I have read it, I have listened to it, and I have started rereading it again because I wanted to get all the concepts and everything that y'all were talking about these women and their some of their terrifying incidents and some of them not. So what made you want to collaborate with Andrea? Is that how you say her name, Andrea or Andrea?
Andrea.
Okay. Yeah. Andrea, to do this book.
So A Haunted History of Invisible Women happened because about 10 years ago, Andrea and I were both asked to present ghost stories at this cool candlelit bar in Brooklyn in New York. Sweet. And I've been a New York City tour guide for a long time. And I knew that Andrea had started a company called Burrows of the Dead, which was like a very well reviewed and well regarded ghost tour company in New York. And I really liked her mission with that company, which was like leading with respect for the dead, first and foremost, and leading with accurate history, because a lot of times on ghost tours, people can kind of fudge the history and things like that. And because they're not as concerned with that as they are about telling the ghost story. But as someone who does, you know, really value the historic facts, I really appreciated how she was running the company. So I walked up to her after we'd, you know, done our ghost stories. And these were ones that we'd created rather than ones that were sort of folklorically, you know, present in a historic space. We'd sort of made these up. And I went up to her and said, you know, if you need another guide for your company, I do have my tour guide's license and I would love to work for you. And so, you know, sort of did the
put it bluntly.
So subtle hard sell there. And she was like, oh, well, I probably should take on another employee. At that time, she was the only person running this company, but the way that she had created the company, it seemed like it was this massive operation. And so technically was her first hire. I was her outside of herself. And so, you know, this was 10 years ago, and, you know, our book together was not even a glint in either of our eyes. But we really had a shared mission and love of telling, you know, real stories, honoring the people who really lived, dealing with some very complicated history often, and trying to do that in a balanced way. And then also share the really weird stuff that is you know, tracked some of these historic spaces. So I was giving, you know, fast forward several years later, I was working for Birds of the Dead, enjoying it very much. And an editor who is familiar with my fiction. So I'd been writing and publishing fiction professionally with traditional mm-hmm. publishers since 2009. And so I was on, at this point, I think I was on book number 12 or 13, when an editor who was familiar with my work came on one of my ghost tours and said, I love your fiction, but you know, you really should think about doing a book of ghost stories and sharing this, you know, history forward approach where you're dealing with real, as much veracity and reality as you can, as you're able to gather. Sometimes, which, you know, histories can sometimes be hard to pin down. And then, you know, let's see if we can make something like this happen. And, you know, the editor really liked my approach, trying to sort of look around the concept of what were these stories also telling us as the living? What were some of these things we could take with us as an audience for these stories? And I didn't feel that I could take that concept and run with it without Andrea, because that was so much part and parcel of how Burrows of the Dead presented ghost tours. So I really wanted to create a partnership. Much as she brought me onto her company, I turned around and said, hey, Andrea, I want to do a book of ghost stories, but I really want to do it with you. So it was this kind of great way of like being able to bring each other on to projects that, you know, we were passionate about. And it was just such an organic flow of collaboration that went very much part and parcel with how we'd worked as guides, where we respected each other's process. We respected the fact that we thought about the paranormal a little bit differently. I'm sort of the, in the X-Files relationship here, I'm more the Mulder and she's more the Scully. But that's kind of worked really well, I think, when you're kind of trying to come at some complicated history and complicated stories that were not, you know, not always one note at all. So in terms of the pitching of this being a book of women's ghost stories, that really went part and parcel with something that Andrea was doing already, which was a Ghostly Women of Greenwich Village tour. And it was actually a tour that she was doing for Women's History Month. And it got so much interest and press from like the New York Times and a bunch of other, you know, major Bustle and BuzzFeed and other things were like asking her about this connection between women and ghosts and women and ghost tours. Because, you know, we were noticing that the bulk of our people who are taking our tours were women. And so that was just an interesting intersection. So we wanted to kind of dive into that and really unpack some of that. And especially when you talk about ghost stories, there's just a lot of interesting lore that you can tap into where women have become like an amalgam of different things. The various white ladies that you've, you know, seen across, history. Sometimes you've got a specific person, and then other times you've got this wide open space where the concept of a woman has fed into this narrative. So we just really wanted to unpack these things. So basically, this is just an exploration of women's history and the intersection of that history and ghost stories and where, how women fit into that narrative. Women have been associated with life and death, birth and caretaking, and very often historically taking care of bodies and dressing them for a wake. And, you know, the ghost lore, even some of the famous ghost story writers, a lot of them were women too. A lot of the famous Gothic novelists were women too, adding into this sort of folkloric concept of how do we talk about a spirit, a living person, and then what happens when they've gone and how do we talk about them then? So this grew out of the past 10 years of our work and out of my work in fiction, because all of my books have ghosts in them. And so this felt very, very organic. It was an editor who said a thing after a tour, and then a tumbling of meetings and discussions about what this was going to be. And it came out last fall and it's now nominated for a Stoker Award. And we're very excited. It's one of those things where it happened in a way that I feel just very, I feel very blessed by. And my own sort of love of the spirit world and connection to the spirit world, I really feel like I had the spirit world along with me for this whole journey, just kind of guiding me and helping me understand the stories that wanted to be told. So that's how that came to be. And then we can talk a little bit further, depending on your questions, about the structure of it and how we made our choices. But it came to be because an editor said, hey, you should do this thing. And when an editor in publishing says, hey, you should do this thing, as someone who likes to be employed by publishing, I said yes.
That is awesome. That is awesome. Well, I like I said, I've read your book. I've listened to the narrator, and it was funny because I was listening to the narrator, and whenever I spoke with you before and I interviewed you before, you told me your name was Leanna Renee Heber, and we had a little discussion about my daughter having the same middle name, but when she was pronouncing it, it was also like proper.
Right.
Renee, and I'm like, did I say your name wrong?
No, it is all good. Well, especially, you know, especially coming from the South, because like, I grew up in Ohio, so but I grew up in rural Ohio, and so everyone has a bit of a little bit of a twang, and so there's a lot of Leanna out there, so it's like I'm cool with that. That is not untrue. So however the A wants to be said is all good. I have heard it all. Just put the A on the, and my only thing is I just want the A to be on the end of it. Some people call me Leanne, and then I'm like, no, I have A on the end. Because that's from my grandma. That's Leanna parts from my grandma. So
yeah, gotta have that. Definitely. Well, I was gonna go into the book and talk about, because I did love, there was one part about this one ghost in Alabama that was really amazing. Because, you know, I'm from L.A., Alabama. But no, I was going to ask you, like, how did y'all come to just put the particular ghost stories that you did into the book? How did you narrow it down? Because there's so many.
There's so many. And there's also so many that we didn't get a chance to put in this book. I mean, this one of the things that we want to be clear with readers is that this is not an encyclopedia of women's ghost stories. That was not our purview. That was not what our direction was. Kensington was not going to publish a really thick encyclopedia. That it was very clear what our word count was going to be and our time frame was going to be. And so we had to pick, I don't actually know the ending count, because some of the chapters we talk about things just briefly, and then other ghosts we give full chapters to. But we tried to pack as much as we could in, knowing that we've left a bunch of famous things out. But in a lot of the cases for the things that we left out, we didn't feel that we either had something new to bring to that discussion or wasn't sure what our angle in was going to be. And so Andrea and I plan to be writing and working in ghost lore as long as publishing will have us. So we'll get around to just about everything eventually. but in this particular case, we really just honestly wanted to honor the spirits that truly called to us, the ones that just we couldn't get out of our heads, literally the ones that haunted us. So, you know, her and I spent months just poring over different texts, a lot of times, you know, local, small press, local lore, you know, that we'd found on one of our travels or that we found in wonderful labyrinthine bookstores and in various places that we'd gone. You know, I travel a lot for different conventions. I always try to go into spaces and see what kind of local ghost lore is here. If I have time, I'll try to do a local ghost tour if at all possible. So, you know, I was very much drawn to places that I had been or that I had kind of a understanding of the energy of the place, if at all possible, but I didn't want that to limit because, you know, we were also writing this during the pandemic. And so traveling to certain locations was difficult. Obviously difficult during that time, but thankfully libraries and historical societies still had their archives open and still had people that you could call and, you know, ask for some references for, which was really, really helpful. We knew going in, there's going to be a couple of very, very famous stories that we knew that we had to do. Andrea has always been interested, intrigued, and compelled by Lizzie Borden. I knew that that was her thing. I never really had any kind of way in for that. So I was like, that is all you. She knew that I had Sarah Winchester. That's my girl.
Yes.
So I knew that I was going to, as soon as I could, get out to the Winchester Mystery House, and I did. I made a pilgrimage there and met with the house historian there, and was able to actually get a lot of really in-depth discussion with her from a woman who's caretaking that house, her thoughts about the narratives there. And so there were a few things that we knew that were going to be like our tent poles for the book. Mm-hmm. And then everything else was just things that really just like kind of sung to us, the stuff that just, you know, either chilled us or delighted us. And like you're mentioning with the Alabama, I think that was mm-hmm. Was that the Huntington College?
Yes.
Is that that one, just the imagery of that is what Andrea talks about that one all the time, because it's one of her favorite ones in the book. And the Red Lady of Huntington College was just this really evocative theme of the color of red and how that wove its way through the ghost stories. And I think, you know, sometimes the imagery of how this lore persists, whether it's easy to substantiate or whether it has just become almost an urban legend, and it is hard to pin down, because Andrea tried to pin down who was this Red Lady.
Yeah.
And there was not really a name that she could pin down, even with all of the discussions with the college staff.
Oh my gosh.
So
wow.
Yeah, because there wasn't a quote unquote, and I'm quoting the college here, wasn't a maiden name that they could find. Huh. So that, you know, sometimes it's really tough when you're talking about ghosts that sometimes only have one, you know, like a first name.
Right.
And we cover this some in the book that, especially in the 19th century, if you've got like a very, you know, because ghost lore from the Victorian era really persists, because that was such a codified time. Like, you know, the 19th century was so into ghosts and telling ghost stories and seances and all the stuff. And the first ventures into paranormal investigation really is happening in the 19th century. And so much of our ghost lore is pinned in that time period. But women, when you would get married, you would lose your name entirely. You would become Mrs. Male name entirely. And so a lot of times those maiden names, it makes some of that, you know, records hard. And also in terms of property ownership, that didn't really come into play for a lot of women until the late 19th century. So there's, you know, pinning some of these things down was a little bit difficult. So we had to find things that had enough heft to be able to write a full chapter about. Otherwise, if it was a great image, then we would fold that into like our introduction chapters. So it really was the things that called to us, that truly haunted us. And we wanted a range of things that were inexplicable, some things that we could debunk, because we had to deal with what happens when you're dealing with demonstrably false narratives. How do you unpack that? There's still value to be gleaned from some of the created stories.
Yeah.
It tells us a lot about our collective, you know, collective unconscious, as it were. So yeah, there's so many more that have yet to be gleaned. So, you know, this for us, this was the beginning of something of a continuing of a lifelong journey of exploration. So, but these were the ones that just they rose to the forefront, because they were the ones that literally either delighted us or wouldn't let us sleep at night.
Oh my goodness. Wouldn't let you sleep at night.
Oh yeah. That's me in 14 West 10th Street. My chapter called The Unreliable Narrator.
Yes.
That's the one that I just can't. That's an address that just has such a bad energy, and I have just had such a weird personal experience with it. And reading the narrative that went along with that before, it deals with a woman, Jan Bryant Bartell, who wrote a book. I'm going to show it to you. Do a little show and tell here.
Bye.
So this is the book called Spindrift that Jan Bryant Bartell wrote about living in 14 West 10th Street. And look at her. She's just, look how beautiful she is.
She's gorgeous.
Just a striking, incredible woman. And she wrote this book while living in this very haunted house. And she writes her experience about 14 West 10th Street, which is known in ghost lore circles and in on New York City ghost tours as the most haunted house in Manhattan. It's been dubbed and nicknamed the Murder House, and all of these, you know, really dark things have happened there. She was chronicling this in this book. It's an out of print memoir. It came out in the 1970s, and she died before it was actually published. And so you know this walking into this narrative, because it's on the dust jacket, that this was basically like her kind of swan song to this haunted life. And that in and of itself is chilling, because the the effects of the house really kind of got to her to a point where it really truly worsened her health. And she chronicles these numerous people who are ill or dying at this address. And then this book is published. And then several years later, there is an actual murder in that house. And it's a nasty, the details of it are nasty. It's a child that was murdered. And it's just,
oh my God.
And this was a national case, and all of this, it was a media spectacle around it, and discussions of domestic abuse as well as child endangerment. Like these were themes that were coming out here. And yeah. I kind of wish that somehow we could have as a society sort of listened to Jan kind of warning everybody about this house, because people said that when Joel Steinberg moved into that address, that just something kind of changed about him. There was a darkness that sort of took over him, kind of like, you know, in Stephen King's The Shining, how you see that when the Overlook really gets a hold of that main character, how dark and twisted that becomes. And so that particular address, I just had very weird encounters with, you know, walking by things, weird synergies that were happening as I was reading Jan's book. At stuff that just was an uncanny kind of experience, not to mention just being out front of that address. I actually have a hard time like breathing around it.
Oh, wow.
Even talking about it. Like even when I talk about it, I actually have an actual hard time breathing. It just has such a effect. And maybe some of that at this point is psychosomatic, very well may be the case. But I'm also just very aware of that there's just a dark energy in that place, and it's not really been able to be pinned down. But so in that particular chapter, I was going it's probably one of the most personal things I've written, because I really kind of opened up and said, here's some of my own personal fears about these things. As I'm a writer, kind of afraid to invoke dark energies. I much prefer happy haunting stories or quirky haunting stories or stories where the ghosts and the energies are playful.
Yeah.
But that's not the case in every case. This one's something that's got a real darkness and also has a narrative associated with it. We want to be very cautious about, because some, you know, people have died there, and we want to be respectful of that. Rather than just saying, oh, you know, look how creepy. At the end of the day, we just also have to be mindful that this is something that is also full of pain and trauma for the people involved as well. So that's the one, when I say the ones that couldn't let us sleep at night, that was definitely the one that I had a lot of anxiety about, and even still do talking about it, even though it's like a noted chapter. A lot of folks will be like, wow, that one really.
It was
like, yeah,
it was. I suggest you guys get the book and read that chapter, because that is a very deep chapter.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. I suffered for that one, but many people suffered far worse. So that's, you know, keeping this kind of stuff in perspective too. It's like, yes, we can be affected by these stories, but at the end of the day, we have to pay respect to the people that suffered the most in some of these, because we're not, you know, a lot of these histories, some of these women lived very, very hard lives.
Yeah, they did.
And that is that's something we want to honor. And not everybody in the book is a good woman either. Like, you know, women have a capacity to be monsters and monstrous, just like anybody.
Oh, they do. They do.
So, you know, we talk about murderers and we talk about nasty, bad people. And we don't we're not interested in rehabilitating those images at all. It's just a matter of like, okay, well, here's the ghost stories attached to this. And how does that go into our discussion of how we look at these people as history's gone on?
Yeah.
You know, Mary Surratt, who was a co-conspirator to the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, she's been kind of rehabilitated in some ways, almost romanticized in her ghost stories. But the fact of it is, she was guilty. So, you know, these are things that we just have to kind of grapple with. And each one of our chapters tries to kind of say, hey, here's some food for thought about these things. At the end of the day, we are not trying to tell you what to think. We are not trying to tell you that you have to be a believer. We're not trying to tell you that you have to think this, that, or the other about ghosts. We are just saying, here's some stuff that we've thought about ghosts. And sure, we've got opinions. And sure, you know,
everybody does.
Everybody's got some opinions. And some of those opinions, you'll inevitably see are opinions within the narrative. We can't completely remove ourselves from these things.
No.
You know, it's Andrea has had very specific experiences being a mother in U.S. healthcare, you know? So it's like there's, she's got some, you know, she has her own experiences that she's bringing to bear in those things. And her own pain in involving a loss. And the, there's definitely what we hope at the end of the day that, that folks can see is that is our love for the subject matter and our love for what we're working on and our love for what we're trying to grapple with. Because at the end of the day, we're still dealing with existential questions that we can't answer. We're not about to prove to you the existence of ghosts. We can't do that. Science isn't there
yet.
It may get there at some point. And I'll be fascinated to see how paranormal investigators deal with that. If technology does bridge the gap between the known and the unknown. I have no idea. A lot of ghosts do seem like they could be a physics equation. It's just a matter of like, one, I certainly don't understand the math. So, you know, that's, hopefully folks will kind of come away with their own sense of like, I wonder how ghost lore in my community or the ghost stories that I've heard through the years, what does that say about me or my family or people that I know? And like, not in a way that's like, othering, but we hope in a way that's actually creating a broader community of discussion around the topic of ghosts in and of themselves. I think that they can really bring people together.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, that's how you and I met.
Exactly.
Was through paranormal, a convention that involved horror and paranormal and all kinds of stuff. And I met Leanna through that. Well, before the convention, really, because I met you through Tom.
Yeah. We were just, I mean, we all knew we were going to be a part of this convention and we were trying to, you know, you were doing great, beautiful graphics work. And we were all connecting about like trying to make sure that we were going to be there and make the best of an event. And we did.
We did. It was I loved it.
Yeah, I did too. And I think that that's because it's like you go for a meeting of the minds. And I think the great thing about the paranormal world is that it's a meeting of questing minds. It's a meeting of minds that are looking and seeking and wanting information without trying to feel like it has to be pinned down to any one thing because we don't know what that is yet. And so I think that like, for me, my introductory section into Haunted History of Invisible Women, my introduction section is called Existential Questions. Cause at the end of the day, that's really like what drives me in my fiction writing and in my nonfiction writing is like, let's examine another aspect of the great existential question that is life and the human spirit and the resilience of it. I think that's actually an inspiring thing we can take from ghost lore is the resilience of the human spirit. So, you know, hopefully we can, you know, find ways to bridge, you know, to bridge our own difficult grappling with mortality too. I mean, I do think that the paranormal folks who work in paranormal also are able to have healthy discussions about grief and mourning and loss and mortality in a way that I feel like our doors are already open to these things that a lot of society says, no, we can't talk about these things.
Yeah.
No, we kind of have to. And it's healthier to do so, but we got to do so with an open heart.
Yep. Open heart and open mind, because with both, you're going to, I mean, the whenever you're in this field, speaking as a paranormal investigator, you do still have days of like, I've got so much to do. I don't want to go anywhere. But then you got to think about, well, if you are an intelligent spirit in the afterlife, you're not really going anywhere. Your spirit is just going in a, well, your body is just going, but your spirit is going to be wherever you want it to be. Which comes to my question, what makes the spirits stick around these places, some of these places that are in, that had a horrible, like the factory, the sewing factory.
The factory, the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, that's, we start the book with the most horrific workplace accident that our country has ever seen. And it happened because there were no labor laws. It happened because a company did not upkeep any of its safety measures, and it was not required to by law at that point. So And so things that are commonplace in buildings now, in structures, the concept of stairwells having metal staircases, that's common now. In this case, yeah, there were wooden staircases between the three floors where the fire was broke out. So this was March 25th, 1911, when this happened. And it was the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the unfortunately named Ash Building, A-S-C-H Building. And now it is renamed the Brown Building. It is a part of New York University now. So the building itself still stands. The exterior was fireproof. The interior and the people, not so much. And the all three floors were very quickly engulfed in when the fire broke out. They never were able to pin down exactly what happened, either a struck match or it possibly... a pool of scrap fabric. It was a garment factory. So shirt waists in the 19th century, early 20th century, were very long shirts, kind of blouses that, you know, men and women would wear that were like a basically work, kind of a work shirt, general staple of middle class wardrobe for sure. So, and New York was the top garment producer in the world at that point.
Hey, this is Shauna.
Don't forget to click that like, subscribe, follow, you know the drill, wherever you watch, wherever you listen. And thank you so much for your support.
I'll be right back after this commercial break.
Hey, this is Lee from the Dead Zone. I want to give a huge shout out to Shauna and congratulations on her new podcast, Exploring the Paranormal Perspective. You'll hear some amazing guests like me.
Whatever.
Paranormal and true crime stories and more. Catch her Wednesdays at 8 Central on the Para-X Radio Network.
What happens to a ghost when their home is torn down? No one thinks of the disembodied when they rip down old buildings, dig up cemeteries, and build clean, unhauntable condos. Every year, hundreds of spirits are driven out of their own haunts by the careless living to exist alone with no one to scare. At Para-X Radio, our hosts feel the plight of these evicted disembodied, and we're reaching out to you to please open your heart to one of these lost souls, such as the ghost soldier of the General Wayne Inn or the abandoned spirit cat of Benjamin Rush. So please, please, let a little spooky into your life. Won't you open your house to a ghost without a home?
Para-X. In order for the light to shine so brightly, the darkness must be present. Tune in every Monday at 10 o'clock for Dark Sun Rising on the Para-X Radio Network.
We all go through life secure in the knowledge of who we are. But what would you do if one day you found out that you grew up in a family that wasn't quite as normal as you were led to believe? You see, the world around us is very complex. It's made up of many layers. And when you start to peel back those layers, either by choice or by accident, you just might discover a hidden truth. The magical world and the mortal worlds are intermingled, with no physical boundary between them. It's all a matter of perception. In Shelley Gordon's case, it's also a matter of destiny. And what she uncovers about herself after her chance encounter with Timothy Titchmarsh, a mysterious little old man with a twinkle in his eye, changed her life completely. He told her of shocking, carefully guarded family secrets that had been unspoken for many generations. But the biggest shock of all was learning that she was not only a witch, but the great-granddaughter of an elite sorceress who tragically died before she could carry out a vital and perilous task that Shelley was now fated to complete. The thought of having to learn the craft, integrate herself into the magical world, and risk her life to finish the task is enough to give anyone a bad case of the collywobbles. Marla Brooks' new fiction book, A Bad Case of the Collywobbles, is now available at Amazon.com in both paperback and Kindle formats. Visit her website at marlabrooks.com to find out more.
Welcome back with your host, Shauna, with Exploring the Paranormal Perspective.
Garment producer in the world at that point. And so sweatshops were everywhere. So it was an overcrowded building with a great deal of immigrant labor from all around the world. Swedish, Ukrainian, Russian, Jewish, Italian, all kinds of different immigrant groups that were coming from all around the world, seeking a better life, seeking, escaping famine or pogroms or other, or, you know, genocides. All kinds of global conflicts were driving a lot of immigration at that point into New York City. And so you've got this overpacked three floors of these, you know, people packed around sewing machines, and this fire broke out and the doors were locked because they were trying to keep labor union organizers out. So all of the exit doors were locked except for one up on like the 10th floor. And then they were on the 10th floor, there were skylights. And so some of the women were able to escape onto the roof. Now I say women, when I'm referencing the deaths in the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, I tend to say women. It was not exclusively women, but out of the 146 people that died, 123 of them were women as young as 14 years old. There were children working in this factory, because this was also the time before child labor laws. And so they were working long days without any safety precautions. They were locked in. They were locked in not only to keep labor union organizers out, but also they were not allowed to go out to use the restroom, things like that. Just basic human decency that was not at all allowed in these particular conditions. And the shirtwaist workers had been striking about this. In fact, the year prior was the uprising of the 20,000, where 20,000 people fled, ran out from their factories and gathered in Union Square. In this sort of central lower Manhattan to protest inhumane working conditions. And out of that in 1910, out of that uprising of the 20,000, it was the largest labor movement uprising and gathering that had ever been taken place in our country at that point in 1910. And that was led by women as well. And a lot of the labor, a lot of the factories did in fact listen to the worker complaints and installed, some went so far as to install sprinkler systems. Others just stopped locking their doors. Others did, in fact, reinforce their fire escapes, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
The only company that did none of these things was the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. And the exterior fire escapes were not maintained, and they rusted through. Several women stepped out onto them, and then they plunged to their death. From the ninth story, and it the fire department was on hand immediately, but the fire department had been asking for more resources, because New York as a city was growing exponentially,
right?
Story by story, skyscrapers were starting to come into vogue by the early 1900s, and so the fire ladders only went up to the sixth floor, which was the average floor for like a tenement building, but not necessarily for a new factory building. And so imagine if the tragedy, just, it breaks my heart every time I talk about this. I have a hard time ever talking about this in a linear manner. I get all jumbled because my heart is just still so broken about all of these details, because imagine you're dealing with this fire that's licking your heels, and you look down and you can see help. You can see the fire department and their ladders, but it's two stories down from you. And there were nets, there were safety nets that they unrolled to see if they could get jumpers, if they could catch them safely. They couldn't. There the mass of a body from the eighth, ninth, or 10th floor went through the nets and onto the street. And we, as a city, were dealing with hundreds of bodies in the street. It's nasty. It's horrific. A New York Times reporter wrote every last grisly detail, not because he wanted to sensationalize what was happening.
Right.
He just wanted the public to understand how horrific this was. And he remembered the girls striking the year prior and mentioned it in the article. I remember these girls that were asking for safety protections, that this right now, what we're seeing, wouldn't happen. And they warned us. And so that's really all this to say, that's what the spirits, if there's anything there, we don't have any there's not a named ghost that's there. There's not anybody that has been specifically seen. Oh, this is this person. Mm-hmm. We do know the names of most of the victims. They didn't know at first because they didn't check all the foreign language newspapers. So there was a lot of unnamed dead in the beginning. Obviously, they're very hard to identify. Those that didn't jump were burned alive inside mm-hmm. the floors. And so for a long time, there were a group of unnamed dead. But through lots of history and translating a lot of the foreign language newspapers that the immigrant population were reading and memorializing their dead in, they were able to pinpoint the names from most people. So there isn't, while those names are put onto carnations and laid out in front of the Triangle building every March 25th by the AFL-CIO labor unions that come and lay these named carnations down to honor those victims. There's not a named spirit that is said to wander these halls. The halls now are, as I mentioned, part of NYU. It's part of their biological studies department. It's like, you know, natural sciences department. Yeah. And so it's a bunch of lab coats and microscopes up there. And I've walked the upper floors, and you don't have any sense of the factory that it used to be. And the students there have reported through the years, even not knowing anything about the fire. For a long time, New York University didn't want to say anything about the fire.
Oh, wow.
Because they didn't want to be beholden to questions or anything like that, or beholden to putting up a plaque or anything like that. But there is a plaque now. The historic society kind of insisted, the historic landmark commission really insisted, no, this really has to go. A plaque has to go on the side of this building noting this tragedy.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
But the spectral memory. So we talk about, and you know this from your mm-hmm. paranormal investigating, place memory and spectral residue. The impact of something that horrific, it scars a place. It leaves a mark, like flash paper. Mm-hmm. You know, something in front of the flash paper will leave its mark upon it. And that's really how that's thought of, that there's a place memory there. There's a heavy weight. And some people have, secretaries who've worked in that building have reported smelling smoke, hearing sounds of fire, seeing shadows falling from the upper windows as if it were a jumping person. And that stuff is deeply chilling. It's not that there's a, it's not, I don't, I, as I say in the book, I cannot believe, I refuse to believe that there's any spirit that's there that's in any kind of prolonged torment. That's not really how these kinds of things work. Yes, their panic might be imprinted upon that building, that those moments of terror do leave their mark, but there's not this prolonged endless suffering that's in there. What there is reminders of the fire. So there is a, sometimes a scent and a sense memory. So whether it's clairaudient and you're hearing a sound of fire or screams or a fire bell, or there is a smell of smoke, that's there as a reminder that this happened. And so for me, that place memory is a rallying cry to make sure that we, the living, do not let our protections expire. We have to make sure that we do upkeep on our buildings and ensure that our employers make sure that we have access to be able to exit safely from a building if there's a problem. Right. So those basic human decency actions, those have to be in play. And that did happen after the fire, but it took the horror of the fire to enact labor law at all. Yeah. And that was the work of people who had directly seen the fire in person, then a very important woman spearheaded that. Her name is Frances Perkins, and she was the first woman cabinet member in under FDR's White House. So she was the first female Secretary of Labor. She was the fourth Secretary of Labor and the first female cabinet member. And she watched. She'd been having a cup of tea in a cafe nearby when it happened, and she walked out and she saw it unfold, and she stopped everything she was doing and devoted the rest of her life to labor law. It was the only way she could reconcile what had happened was through activism. So, so there are ways in which to turn this around into like a rallying cry, just for human decency. And so that's really, for me, that's, that area is haunted by, I, as a ghost tour guide, it is up to me to make sure that I am saying to my living patrons, mm-hmm. hey friends, just make sure you're looking out for yourself, and make sure that no one gets to erode your safety. That's mm-hmm. no one has the right to say that their company is more important than your life.
Exactly. And you know, I have a Perkins in my family. So whenever you mentioned that, I was like, I related?
That would be amazing.
It would.
She's an incredible.
She is. Perkins
is an incredible lady. It's just.
I don't think anybody in her family went south, though.
I don't know.
I don't know, though. I was looking, and what I saw so far, I haven't seen anything. But,
well, it's still a cool name, so
who knows, I'll have to dig a little deeper and see, because
yeah.
That is very, very interesting. I had to look it up. I was like, oh, Perkins,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, well, that is the thing. That's one of the great things about
history,
ghost lore, and haunted spaces, yep. and historic spaces that are encouraging you to look into these records and things like that.
Yeah,
you never know. Like, we're all connected. We're all, you know, and sometimes these things, as I'm sure you've experienced when you're on investigations, like the synergy, the stuff that happens when you're like, wait a minute,
yeah,
a strange connection that just seems, it's like it's almost too strange to be coincidence kind of stuff.
Exactly.
I truly believe that in this work there are things that just kind of, and that's how Andrea and I felt about compiling this book. We just felt like these stories kind of came to us as like, okay, these are the ones that want to be told the most right now.
Yeah.
And then other ones will want to be told in other ways, depending on how we write about things in the future.
Definitely. Oh my gosh. But yeah, it's interesting. And hey, Dawn. Dawn says, welcome, Leanna.
Thank you.
There are a lot of different, like you said, connections that go into things like this. And it is kind of weird whenever you go by a building and you feel that, like, kind of pull, like something is, you know, kind of watching you or looking at you. I mean, there's a building here locally that I go by every time, and it's like, there's something there. There's got to be.
Mm-hmm.
But you have connections because you can kind of see and hear.
I do, and I talk only, like, I'm very careful about how I talk about this in the book, because I want to really maintain a certain amount of neutrality for the reader.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want my experiences, and I do share experiences that I've had in haunted spaces. So I talk about a time in which I was touched, I was grabbed fondly. It was actually it was a very sweet encounter in the merchant's house, where I was actually sort of grabbed by the elbow, kind of enthusiastically, as I was talking. I just burst into sort of a delighted and thankful exclamation about how glad I was that the building was still standing, because there was a history with this wonderful historic house. The merchant's house on 4th Street in New York had a really narrow window. It was almost lost to history. And I just, the concept that we would have lost this real treasure, a building that has influenced a great deal of my fiction, because I've based a lot of my floor plans and thoughts about how a Victorian middle class and upper class homes would look like, and the furnishings and just the ways of it, it became an invaluable resource for me as a writer. And so learning about its history and how close we were to losing it, I just sort of exclaimed, thank God it was saved. I just had this moment, like this, you know, eruption. And I felt this really fond squeeze. And you know how you can kind of feel the mood or the sentiment of a touch. And it was just this really fond squeeze on my elbow. An ice cold hand clamped, squeezed gently, kind of lovingly on my elbow. And I thought it was my friend Amanda, who admittedly has bad circulation. So I thought it was her cold hand, but it was not. I turn and there's nothing there. There's just the beautiful red settee that's there, that happened to be, as I talked to the docent afterwards, happened to be the most haunted spot. Is that corner of the entire house was the most haunted spot. And so, you know, I've had moments. I talk about, the other, you know, strange, weird coincidence things that were happening with 14 West 10th, other ways in which I felt and experienced energies and things like that. But I wanted to keep my own kind of woo out of the narrative. And I'm vocal about it when I'm talking to people in person. But I wanted to make sure that it didn't feel like I was sort of leading the witness in a way when I'm here in the narrative. So, you know, when people ask me questions about, okay, well, how does the spirit world, you know, affect you or appear to you? I will answer that, you know, very honestly, which is, it really depends. It's never consistent. And it's always either one of my five senses or that sixth sense where you just know and you don't know how you know.
Right.
And you feel and you don't know how you feel because you can't actually tie it to your other five senses. So it's not a consistent way in which those things either manifest to me or speak to me. But I've had moments where I've gotten messages, and I've had moments where I've seen things, and moments where I've heard things or smelled things or noticed that something is in the middle of the floor that was not there in the middle of the floor a moment prior. You know, things like that, those sorts of inexplicable things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if it's not directly relevant to the narrative that I'm telling, I really am trying to always be careful that I'm not inserting too much of myself into this to a point where it's going to take away from the star of this particular chapter is right. The woman I'm writing about, or the history or the place or the location that I'm writing about. So I try to strike that right balance. But, and Andrea's a little bit more of a skeptic than me, although she's had a bunch of experiences, and it's very funny because I'm like, you had an experience though. That was a haunting though. You know? And so she just sort of like, you know, Mulder, you know, Mulder. You know, sure. Yeah. Yeah, I want to believe. Yeah. But that's a fun dynamic because like she'll go that extra mile to sort of discount and discredit stuff.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm just sort of like, nah, that's the thing. And I think that provides a really fun balance. And anytime that we're talking about things in tandem together or addressing something, we have that that sort of two sides to an approach. And I think every team should have believers and skeptics alike.
Exactly. Yes. I go to my husband a lot when it comes to asking questions, but he's always no. But I mean, a ghost could go up to him and slap him in the face and he would still say, I did it 2 feet away. Or, you know, it's like, I didn't, what are you talking about? No, he is really a skeptic.
You know, I think I have every understanding. I hold all of that in my heart because just, you know, kind of like how all of us have different aptitudes with our senses. Like without my glasses, my eyesight's not great. Mm-hmm. But my hearing's pretty good, but someone else is going to have like, you know, really great eyesight and maybe their hearing isn't as good. Mm-hmm. All these kinds of different things. We all have different aspects of our senses that are different levels of calibration. Mm-hmm. So some folks just aren't going to be tuned to the sixth sense, and that's totally valid. And to insist that they open up to it, just like, I don't know, that's, I wouldn't want someone to tell me how to live or be or perceive, you know, I wouldn't want someone trying to put that onto me. So I really try to keep open about all of that. But also if people do want to see things or experience things or be open to things, I always caution them to do that carefully. Don't just open yourself up to anything and everything, because then you're opening yourself up to possibly negative energies that aren't going to help you or anyone around you. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, if you are moving into spaces, you're going to want to do so with care and a certain amount of boundaries, like just like with human beings, you got to set boundaries with human beings. You also got to set that with the spirit world, because ghosts, a lot of times, especially the prankster ghosts, will like to mess with you, but you have to say, y'all don't, I can't right now. I have to rest, or no, that's not okay, actually, or this is actually scaring me. You have living privilege. You get to sort of say, hey, no, this is my time right here, my limited time on this planet in this corporeal form. So respect that. And you know, that's the case with any of these things. So I think folks that want to open up more, they can. And there are ways in which to do that. That's also deeply personal. You know, how you open yourself up spiritually, that's deeply personal. I don't tell anybody what to believe in terms of faith any more than I tell them whether they should or shouldn't believe in ghosts. So that's that is between you and whatever you believe or don't believe. That's not on me. But the that concept of boundaries, I think that's just really, really deeply important. And I have had to lay down the law a couple times with spirits who were messing with me. You know, and that particular story didn't make it in the book because it's demonstrably not about women. It's demonstrably about rascal boys, rascal boy ghosts. So if we have time, I can go into that. But I don't want to derail us.
We'll be here as long as you can be here. Well, maybe not 4 hours later, but you know.
Well, I will. So if you all want to hear a story of rascally boy ghosts, I can tell you that story.
Awesome. Well, you'll tell it after this question, though, because somebody in the chat has a question and wants to know, Woodwalker Dawn asks, has she ever tried auto writing? Now, I know the answer to this one because you told me, but.
Well, if you want to find out more, you got to come back next week and listen to part two of my interview with Leanna Renee Heber. Isn't she just awesome, y'all? Come back next week and find out all that you need to know about her auto writing and much, much more with those rascally ghosts on Exploring the Paranormal Perspective right here on ParaX Radio Network. If you want to catch more of my shows, you can go to exploringtheparanormalperspective.com, or if you want to watch the podcast, you can catch clips of it on rumble.com/geeks_paranormal, or just look up Geeks Paranormal Rumble and you'll be able to find me. Or you can go to my back.by page where I'm gonna have the full length video uncut right there for you guys. If you want to catch me live on Sundays to ask your questions to either me or to the guest that I have on the show that day. Coming up this Sunday at 7 p.m. Central Time is the Velisca Axe Murder House Johnny Hauser. Come and join me and ask him questions about the Velisca Axe Murder House or any kind of paranormal thing you want to ask. That's Sunday on kick.com/geeksparanormal. Thanks again and see y'all later.
Everybody, Angel Ray. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to Shauna. She is going to be having a new podcast. Sounds like a lot of fun. I can't wait to be a guest on there myself. Called Exploring the Paranormal Perspective. And you can catch her on Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock Central Time on ParaX Radio Network.
Getting weird, skulls creeping me out. I just wanted to take a second to tell you my buddy, my BFF, my bestie, Shauna's got a new podcast out. It's called Exploring the Paranormal Perspective. She's going to be talking about monsters, mysteries, aliens, ghosts, true crime, paranormal, everything that's interesting. You know, you need to listen to it. ParaX Radio Network, 8 p.m. Central Time, Wednesdays. Tune in.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making ParaX part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, ParaX.